And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. We have open phone lines for a listener to comment in this hour on three international stories. The bloody Israel-Hamas conflict in the Gaza Strip, the downing of the Malaysian jetliner over Ukraine last Thursday, and the ramifications of that that continue today, and the U.S. response to the surge of unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S. border with Mexico. Those three stories we want to spend some time talking about in this hour, primarily Israel and Hamas conflict in Gaza. We'll start with that and move on to the situation in Ukraine and what looks like a face-off now between President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin over this. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. So much international news just in the last few days that we have to sort of parse it out a little bit and talk about it. Our first opportunity here on Midday to do that, so we welcome your calls. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309 to reach us here at WYPR in Baltimore. You can also send a question or comment to midday at wypr.org. I'm happy to welcome back to Midday Kimberly Katz, Middle East expert and associate professor of history at Towson University, who's joined us on the program before to talk about issues related to the Middle East, who has just returned from there after spending some 5 weeks over there, returning earlier this month, now with us in Studio A. Kimberly Katz, nice to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
And Max Hilaire is back, a professor of political science and chair of the Department of Political Science at Morgan State University, also with a considerable scholarship in international law. It's nice to have you back with us, too.
Thanks,
Max.
Dan. Nice to be back.
So, Kimberly Katz, let's start with Israel and Gaza and what's been going on there the last few days. Some just horrific images and stories coming out of the Gaza Strip. You know, we've been here before. This is the third major Israel operation in Gaza in the last 6 years. So I wanted to ask you this, trying to sort all this out. I wanted to start you with this question. It seems like, if not unique, that there's something outside of the core Israel-Palestinian conflict about Hamas and Israel, Hamas and Gaza. That, you know, the root causes of this conflict that's been around for decades now have not been resolved. And now there's something particular going on between Hamas and its control, so to speak, if there is control, in Gaza and Israel. Am I correct that it's sort of outside of the core Israel-Palestinian conflict?
I wouldn't say that it's outside of the core Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel has tried to separate Hamas outside of the core Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and has tried to do that particularly since 2006 when Hamas was elected by the Palestinian people, the last elections to actually be held in the occupied territories. There is a reason for that. Israel, like other colonial powers before it, has tried to have a divide-and-rule policy. And by separating Hamas out from, and the United States has participated very actively in this process of separating Hamas out from the Palestinian leadership. But Hamas is part of the Palestinian people. They were elected by the Palestinian people. But Israel, like the United States, set out to ostracize Hamas, seeing it as an Islamic movement, and divided these two groups. Fatah, which led the Palestinian Authority, which was part of the Oslo process that emerged in 1994, became the leader of the Palestinian Authority that emerged out of the Oslo process, which began in 1993, and never liked Hamas, but in effect, actually, Hamas is a spawn of Israel. The Fatah, the sort of more secular nationalist Palestinian group, was never liked initially by Israel, and they set out to create a kind of alternative group that they could sort of support in the occupied territories, and that was Hamas. So Israel gave support to the establishment of this organization, and when they began to engage in violent means, Israel turned against it, and now that it has gained quite a bit of support in the occupied territories over the last few decades, Israel has violently struck against it and set out to do what it could to divide these two Palestinian factions and to separate the West Bank and the Gaza Strip as much as possible.
So it seems impossible to get to the core problem, the core of the conflict.
Well, the core of the conflict is the occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And a lot of people will say, and we've heard this over and over and over again, that Gaza is not occupied any longer. You'll hear every Israeli official, whether it's a military commander or just this morning on the Diane Rehm show, you heard the deputy ambassador say that we've removed all of our settlers. The problem with the Gaza Strip is that it is still, in effect, occupied. The borders are closed off. The sea is closed off. The airspace is closed off. The Gaza Strip cannot engage in trade. It's blockaded. There's a siege on Gaza. And so the occupation has not ended because Palestinians do not have control over their lives, over their airspace, over their sea space, over their ability to engage in any kind of meaningful trade or to run their lives.
One thing about that, you just mentioned this blockade. It's an Egypt-Israel blockade of Gaza?
It's mainly Israel because Israel controls the airspace, the sea space, and most of the exit crossings which go from the Israeli side. Egypt also maintains a blockade on its side from Rafah, but Israel controls most of the exits and the air and the sea space.
So, Max Hilaire, I'll turn to you. The story Israel sells to the world is we have a right to defend ourselves. Hamas is in Gaza. They're building tunnels, numerous tunnels, more than we realized, in order to infiltrate into Israel or outside of Gaza. And we have a right to do this to defend ourselves. They're throwing rockets at us. Both sides claim that they're the victims of aggression.
Well, there is no question. I mean, Israel does have a right to defend itself. The degree of force used in that defense is really what raises the serious question of legitimacy. I think all states do have a right. I wouldn't say it's a right to self-defense, but the right to protect your civilian population from indiscriminate rocket attacks coming out of Gaza. If the Israelis were striking at tunnels, at military installations, at Hamas military infrastructure, I don't think the response would be as it is now. But when 600 civilians are dead, and particularly women and children, and we see it on television day in, day out, I think it raises a lot of questions, and then perception matters in war. So the Israelis can put out as much information as they want in that they're the victims, but what we see on television and images of children or wounded people, particularly civilians, I think those are what really raise concern and has led to an isolation of Israel, if anything. But I would also
it certainly
like
is
to say,
a lopsided death toll.
Yes. Yeah. I would also like to point out that the situation in Gaza and the Middle East between Israel and the Palestinians is really not a military or security issue. As indicated, you have a political problem. The occupation regime is really the underlying cause for many of the problems between Israel and the Palestinians. And given that Gaza, yes, Israel withdraw, but it has maintained a siege over the territory, there's a sense of hopelessness. So you are in an open-air prison, no escape, you cannot trade, you cannot do business, you cannot bring in and out any goods unless the Israelis allow it. And now you have a government in Egypt that is taking the position, has defined Hamas as a terrorist organization, has cut off any links between Egypt and Gaza, and in actuality is aligned with Israel in terms of its stand on Gaza, which is why Hamas did not accept the ceasefire negotiated by Egypt, because they view the government of Sisi as an illegitimate government.
Sisi, reference to the Egyptian president.
The new president of Egypt.
Kimberly Katz.
On the matter of whether or not Israel has the right to self-defense, in theory, states would have the right to self-defense, but in this particular case, because Israel is an occupying power, according to international law, you can't both be an occupying power with all of the things that go with that, meaning occupying powers are supposed to be responsible for and take care of the occupied population. So you can't both be an occupier and have the right to defend yourself against the population you're occupying. And so there's a real contradiction in terms there, right? If Israel were doing what it's supposed to do with regard to the occupied population, which is take care of that occupation, instead of imposing a siege on the population, it wouldn't have this kind of problem. The reason that Hamas is doing what it's doing, and believe me, I'm not a fan of Hamas per se, but the reason that Hamas is doing what it's doing is because the population is squeezed so brutally and so badly. What happened even prior to the removal of settlers in 2004, already you began to have the Israeli government study and implement in 2006, after it withdrew its settlers, something called the Diet. The Diet was a program that Israel has implemented in which it allows in only a specific amount of calories per person per day. It's something like 2,276 calories per person, so that it's in effect, it's actually starving the population of Gaza. There's only 131 trucks that are allowed in per day. So this is in effect because they're not allowed to trade, because the border with Egypt is closed, because Israel only allows a certain amount of trucks in per day, because
Why?
The sea is because not
of
open.
Is it because of fear of Hamas? Is that it?
Because it's
is that
fear
the
of
rational,
Hamas.
Rationalization?
Because it doesn't want to allow Hamas to act as an effective government, because it might become popular, because it might become something that Israel doesn't want it to become. So here we get into the subject of the tunnels. Why do the tunnels come? The tunnels are mostly used, yes, they are sometimes used for smuggling in weapons, but they are mostly used to smuggle in goods for people. So Israel wants to destroy the tunnels so that, again,
Israel is
Hamas,
presenting the tunnels as a part of the Hamas military operation.
As solely the Hamas military option. And
today,
they're not saying that they're used at all to bring in goods for people.
Okay. Thank you very much. And furthermore, the talk of ceasefire, you know, we have the UN representative, the President Ban Ki-moon, and John Kerry, the Secretary of State now, I guess, is in Egypt, right? They got there Monday. And there's talk about, you know, a ceasefire. How do we get to a ceasefire? Gilad Erdan, who is Director of Communications, the Minister of Communications for Israel, said Israel must not agree to any proposal for a ceasefire until all the tunnels are eliminated. So they will continue on. That's why today Israel's forces continue to pound on Gaza. Back to you on this, Max.
Well, you may not be able to eliminate all the tunnels or bomb all the tunnels. So if the Secretary General and Secretary of State Kerry and the Egyptian government are able to mediate negotiate some kind of ceasefire, I think all eyes will be on the Israelis to at least show a willingness to accept, because the public opinion is so much against what is going on, against Israel's action in the Middle East, that and Israel obviously
is
isolated.
Is this true? I mean, you would think so because of the images we're seeing, the news reporting that's coming out of Gaza.
Well,
but, I'd like to hear from our listeners for one way of measuring that to see whether
heard the European Union, the United States, the president did say Israel does have a right to defend itself, but the United States has been very measured in its response, unlike previous administrations, in giving blanket support to Israel. I think the president realized there is a danger if this situation escalates. It could lead to more death. It could lead to a spillover effect where, you know, it could destabilize the entire region. So a ceasefire is in everyone's interest, but Hamas has to be brought to the negotiating table in the ceasefire instead of trying to impose a ceasefire on Hamas.
Before we go to the break, Kimberly, I want to ask you about Secretary of State Kerry, his role in this earlier and now.
Can I just say something about public opinion? Mm. I think if you look at the demonstrations that have been going on worldwide, I think there's wide popular opinion against what Israel is doing in Gaza. I think if you look at the U.S. Congress, I think that you see wide support for the state of Israel. There's been a resolution passed in the Senate that's at least 99 or 100 in favor of what Israel is doing. But that, of course, has to do with domestic politics and maybe more to the point, fueling their coffers. They're up for election, some of them, and that has nothing to do with constituencies. That only has to do with money in domestic political elections. As far as the president is concerned, this has to do with supporting politicians in upcoming election races and whatnot, and this has to do with status quo in election politics.
And what about Kerry?
As far as Kerry is concerned, it's actually very interesting because he put in a lot of hours in a peace process that ultimately failed, and I think he genuinely wanted it to succeed. And when it failed, he basically blamed the Israelis for the failure and the settlements. And it's unfortunate because when Obama had a chance earlier on in his presidency to do something significant about the settlements, he didn't. He asked the Israelis to stop settlements building for a matter of 3 months. The Israelis wouldn't do it. There's never any punitive action on the Israelis for their settlement building. There's been a lot of spitting in the faces of the American government by the Israelis, and they do it with impunity. So the latest initiative by the Kerry team also went up in flames, and that is part of what led to what's going on here. It blew up, and now Kerry thinks that he can salvage something by a ceasefire. But again, the ceasefire initiative, the so-called Egyptian initiative, is not going to work because it was announced without any discussion with Hamas, and you're not making peace with your friends. You make peace with your enemies.
Kimberly Katz from Towson University, Max Hilaire from Morgan State. This is Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. We'll take a short break and come back and take some phone calls. We'll also talk about Ukraine and the crisis at the U.S.-Mexican border with the influx of thousands of unaccompanied minors coming across the border. Governor O'Malley had an idea about that yesterday, meeting with religious leaders in Maryland to try to come up with a plan for housing some of those children in this state. 410-662-8780 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. We'll be right back. Let's take a couple calls here. Max Hilaire with me in the studio from Morgan State University, Kimberly Katz from Towson University. Reverend Daki, thank you very much for calling. Go ahead with your comment, please.
Yeah, God bless you. Thank you so much for having this discussion. It's not just a mile long and an inch deep, because oftentimes, we have shock radio, TV, and everything else, and that sensationalizes things without being sensitive to the people impacted at home and abroad. So thank you so much for having this type of discussion. And yay, Morgan Bears. Yeah, I'm a Morgan. So what I wanted to say was, I'm 62 years old, and having been a part of the peace, justice, and freedom movement for many years, working for the American Friends Service Committee, we see some similar things. And being a minister myself, having been mentored by Reverend Vernon Nathaniel Dobson and Reverend Baskin and Perry Mitchell and those activists like Walter B. Carter and other men and women, Marilyn Murphy, you know them, Roderick.
Yes, but please, Reverend Daki, what was the point you wanted to make?
The point I want to make is this, that we have to affirm that all life is sacred. All life is sacred, whether it's an Israeli life or Jewish life, let's say, Palestinian life. And we tend to find ways to take sides, and rightfully so, because we're impacted. But at the same time, Dr. King always had this call to conscience and action, where many of us of whatever faith, whatever race, labor, students, artists, we did it in South Africa, nuclear freeze and the like. We mobilized under a statement that said, we stand on these principles, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, United Nations, our faith commitments and the like. And in doing that, we are called and charged not only to be conscious of this, but to act on it. And so it's good that people are mobilizing and we're looking beyond this devil in the detail stuff, because it's no question Israel has been treated as a sacred cow in this country. Just like, the U.S. foreign policy has been.
Okay,
and we can make a difference when we come together and not just take sides, but demand justice and speak truth to power. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Reverend Daki. What about if these tunnels are an issue? This occurred to me. Max, I'll ask you about it. You're versed in international law, the United Nations. What about a peacekeeping force? What about a security force in Gaza?
Well, it would be all well and good to have a peacekeeping force, but whose forces are going to go into Gaza? I mean, that's number one. Whether you could get the Security Council to agree on a peacekeeping force to go into Gaza. First, you need a ceasefire. Second, you need the cooperation of whatever authority, Hamas or whoever, controls Gaza, and the cooperation of the Israelis.
Okay, I'm not saying it would be easy, but, I mean, you could send inspectors in to say, yes, there are tunnels, yes, they're being used by Hamas, or no, they're being used to get food and supplies in and out of Gaza.
And that is one of the issues the Israelis are making, that if there is to be a ceasefire, they need verification that there are no more tunnels to funnel weapons to Hamas. And I think that could be negotiated on this new ceasefire agreement with the Secretary General present in the talk. So hopefully something can come out, but at the same time, the Israelis have to be willing to at least partially lift the siege if anything is to come out of this. You don't go to the negotiating table and not be willing to give up something to get something. Mm-hmm. So if Hamas is going to accept inspectors, I think the Israelis are going to have to agree to at least partially lift the siege.
Let's take another call. Matthew in Hunt Valley, you're next on Midday. Hi.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, everything I'm hearing at this point about the issue in Gaza says that Israel really doesn't want to have a long-term engagement or occupation. Yet the two sides are basically asking for different things and aren't willing to sacrifice the security or the offensive high ground that would require them to come to a peace agreement. I mean, if they can't even come to a ceasefire at this point, what's going to happen in 2 or 3 weeks when Israel's appetite for an attack comes to fruition, and they're done, there's no longer any energy for it, and they're still in the same position then that they are now, with even more casualties and more invested in the conflict?
I think that's why Hamas is going to remain useful to them, because without Hamas, there's a vacuum of leadership of some kind. Without Hamas, there's still splinter groups that are even more extreme. And so even though Israel, the United States, even Egypt doesn't want to talk to Hamas, didn't include Hamas in the initial, what was called the Egyptian ceasefire agreement, they didn't even talk to Hamas in the first place, they can't omit Hamas from whatever kind of ceasefire ultimately happens, because then there'll be a political vacuum. So Hamas is going to actually remain there. I feel quite certain of that.
Kimberly Katz, what happened to Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority? Is he completely irrelevant now?
He's pretty irrelevant to most of the Palestinians throughout the West Bank. People have no confidence in him to do anything. He is pretty much seen as a lapdog of Israel and of the United States, because they're the only ones who rely on him. So he's sort of going around between Egypt and Qatar and Turkey right now and the United States. And he's supposed to, and he meets with Abu Marzouk, who is a Hamas spokesman. And he's the one who's supposed to sell this, whatever deal they agree on in Egypt, whatever's going to be the new Egyptian ceasefire. He's the one who's supposed to sell it to Hamas and to be the one that ensures that it sticks. Now, there was...
So he's irrelevant to the Palestinians, but not to
right.
The U.S. and Egypt.
Now, the thing is, there was in April a reconciliation agreement that had already come up even a couple of years prior that had never been implemented. And finally, in April, and the reason this whole thing actually got started is because the Kerry plan had failed. The Palestinians had decided to reconcile these two, Fatah and Hamas had decided to reconcile, and Israel didn't want this to actually happen. As I mentioned at the beginning of my comments, Israel prefers a divided strategy than a united strategy. And rather than have Fatah, led by Mahmoud Abbas, and Hamas come together in some kind of united formula, and in fact, the formula that they came up with included no Hamas members. It was a technocratic government. Rather than have them come together, Israel preferred that they remain divided. And the pretext that they used was the kidnapping of the three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank in in June.
Right.
And so that's how this whole thing got started. So this was a war of choice by Israel, not a war of necessity. And we know that because there have been a number of accounts, including in Jewish American newspapers like The Forward, that says that Israel knew that the three mm-hmm. boys were dead already within the first 24 hours of their kidnapping. Mm-hmm. And instead of telling the Israeli public that these teenagers were dead, they used a ruse of saying that for 2 weeks they were going to bring them back alive, they were going to find them. They went on a rescue mission. Instead of telling the Israeli public that, they went on this campaign to find them alive, and they rampaged their way through the West Bank for 2 weeks, destroying homes, arresting some 400 Palestinians, killing six Palestinians, including a few children, and telling people basically to revenge against the kidnapping of the three boys. And what ultimately happened was a revenge attack against a Palestinian in which he was burned alive, a teenager, 16 years old. And one response after that was a Palestinian-American teenager who was then brutally beaten by Israeli policemen.
Kimberly Katz, you were in the Middle East and in Jerusalem for a time in June,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you got back here early July.
Right.
What kind of conversations did you have with Israelis about this? I mean, is there a debate about this? Does anyone hold out any hope for a two-state solution anymore?
The invasion of Gaza had basically taken place right at the time, right on the day that I left. And so what was going on at the time that I was there was the incursions throughout the West Bank and attack against the Palestinian boy. And people thought that this was totally justified because precisely what the Israeli government had done, which was to mount a rescue attack, a rescue campaign, in the same manner that they, you know, were going after Gilad Shalit and this kind of rescue campaign, people thought that this was totally justified. And so the Israeli government sets the expectations. And one of the things that has come out of this, which has really been sort of astounding, and if you read, a lot of different kind of newspapers now, you see that there has been really heightened and increased racism throughout the country. And you can see this because some of the ministers in the Israeli government, which is the most right-wing government that Israel has had in its history since 1948, have called for campaigns of transfer, for wiping the country, of eliminating Arabs from the country. And this is going on inside Israel, and they're calling for this in the West Bank and Gaza. And so what can you expect of citizens if these kinds of things are coming out of the mouths of ministers in the Israeli government?
Talk about a two-state solution then? Is there less? There's just less talk about that, less hope for it?
Well, if the prime minister of Israel said a week ago Friday that he will never, as long as he's prime minister, he will never give up security control of the West Bank, it's hard to imagine that anybody's talking seriously about a two-state solution.
Back to our phone lines. We'll go to Columbia. Sam's calling, questioning something Kimberly Katz said earlier. Sam, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. You know, someone needs to correct the mischaracterization of this conflict by your guest. To say Hamas is the spawn of Israel is really willfully ignoring reality. And they've been in the business of killing innocent Jews and Israelis for years, well before the latest conflict. And even in the 90s, they were blowing up buses and malls. And listening to your guest, it sounds like Israel is being run by some sort of Jewish al-Qaeda. And, willfully and wanting to kill innocent civilians, which is absolutely not true. The fact is that three-quarters of the country are in bomb shelters right now, having missiles rain down on them by a war that they did not wish for. And they're defending themselves against people who use their own civilians and people as human shields. Two, my second point is her contention that the politicians in America are motivated by money from the Jewish donors, which is implying. And that's just rooted in tyranny.
Well, let's go over that then. Kimberly Katz, thank you very much, Sam. Kimberly Katz, let's go over that just quickly. I don't want to spend too much more time on it, but use the word spawn of Israel, meaning the origins, going back to the origins of Hamas.
I would direct Sam to look in a Wall Street Journal article from January 24th, 2009. I took the I should have put it in quotes. There's an article called "How Israel Helped Spawn Hamas," and you can read there, in which there are several quotes from Israelis who participated in the cultivating of somebody named Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. So I'm not sure if Sam has actually studied the history or if he's just following some of the talking points of the Israeli government.
Because what was the motivation of Israel?
Several of the things he mentioned are some of the talking points of the government.
All right, but what were the motivations of the Israelis in doing that?
The motivations were to steer attention away from Fatah, whom the Israeli government never really wanted to deal with. And so Fatah was the secular Palestinian nationalist movement that most Palestinian supported, led by Yasser Arafat since the late 1960s. And so rather than have to deal with Fatah, which the Israeli government saw as a terrorist organization, along with the United States, for a long time until the late 1980s, when 1988, when Fatah decided that it was going to participate in the two-state solution, and then the United States government allowed it to participate in the 1990 Madrid conference. Israel, by that time, had decided in the 1980s that it was going to turn to an alternative. It wanted an alternative in the occupied territories, and so it cultivated an Islamic movement that was just beginning to get off the ground, and it funneled some money. And there's a lot of scholarly literature on this as well. But for the popular audience, they can simply go to this Wall Street Journal article.
You're merely pointing out some of the history there. The history certainly since then is quite different than that.
The history since then is quite different, but there's no getting away from the fact that Israel cultivated this movement. And as I said in my comments, Israel, I'm sure, regrets just as the United States regrets its engagement with what the Mujahideen that became Al-Qaeda, right? The countries that are looking for some kind of alternative to the big bad bogeyman, they then later come to regret when they give financial aid and support to these Islamist groups that then become something even worse than the original organization that they oppose in the first place.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to Hale Thorpe for our next caller. Daniel, you're on Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
And thanks for taking all these calls. I think it's important that people are talking about this. I just wanted to state a comment real quick. You know, I think many people know that Israel is backed by the United States, and we have the Congress, your guest has said, they're all in support of Israel right now. And so they are as guilty as Israel is of what's happening, the mass loss of life. The Palestinians said, I'm not going to be able to come up with a solution in a 30-second phone call, but I think it's pretty obvious to a lot of people that it's crimes against humanity.
What about the claim? I thank you for this, Daniel. But the claim, Max Hilaire, that Hamas hides among civilians, hides its operations in places where there are lots of children, women and children.
Well, it's Gaza is one of the most densely populated areas on Earth. It's 2 million people in a 300 square miles
area. 1.7 million, but
it's 1.7
to 2
million.
But
modern warfare, then, whether it's in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Gaza, it's difficult to separate legitimate combatants from civilians. And hence, whether Hamas deliberately hiding weapons and using civilians as a human shield is really not relevant because of the nature of warfare today. Most wars are concentrated in urban areas. It's difficult to distinguish between a legitimate military target and what's not a legitimate military target. So obviously, and the types of weapons that are being used in these wars simply don't discriminate between civilians and combatants. So whatever you do, the area itself is so densely populated and so heavily concentrated, it's going to be difficult to avoid civilian casualties.
Max Hilaire from Morgan State University, Kimberly Katz from Towson University. We have to take a short break. When we get back, more on this, and we'll also talk about the situation in Ukraine, and I have some emails to read regarding the children who are coming from Central America across the U.S.-Mexico border. So a short break on Midday. We'll come back, talk some more, and take some more phone calls. 410-662-8780. Welcome back to Midday, 410-662-8780. I need to speak with Max Hilaire just for a moment about the Russian President Vladimir Putin. This outrageous thing that happened on Thursday, last Thursday. We haven't had a chance to talk about this yet, Max. So here we go. Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 shot down over the rebel-held areas of Ukraine, southeastern Ukraine. A mystery as to what happened here, but it's pretty clear that, you know, a rocket was fired by somebody in that area that brought down this civilian airliner. 298 people senselessly killed. The president of the United States now calling out the rebels in that area, you know, yesterday demanding that they allow an investigation, allow the return of the remains to the families of these folks. I guess that's happened now. We have a train arriving with the bodies finally, and Vladimir Putin now trying to save some face here. He's been criticized for not having reining in these rebels in this area, the pro-Russian rebels in Ukraine. That's another mess. So,
well, then it's unfortunate what happened to the civilians and to the Malaysian airline. Two serious situations in less than 6 months.
Yeah.
I mean,
the disappearance of the other flight.
So technically, you wonder how long the Malaysian airline is going to be in business for. But I think this is really an act of terrorism, whether it was intentional or it was an error. And Putin and Russia has to take full responsibility for it. They trained, provide all the sophisticated weapons to the rebels. And hence, the responsibility goes back to Russia, because these rebels could not have gained access to such sophisticated weapons, nor could they have the training. And the training was not done overnight. It takes several weeks or months to train people to use such sophisticated weapons. And there's evidence from civilians' photos showing the weapons and the artillery moving into Ukrainian territory, and some of that equipment being moved back to Russia. So I think Putin made a miscalculation. He should have come out initially and distanced himself from the rebels and those responsible.
Instead, he encouraged it.
He encouraged it.
Yes,
and just the manner in which the rebels have portrayed themselves in handling the dead, and protecting the space has given all indication that the Russians knew about it and have something to do with it, and hence we're in the situation that we are in.
I'm not interested in saving face for Vladimir Putin. I just wonder where does he go from here.
Well, I think once the investigation is
sanctions.
Sanctions are one option, but I think what ought to happen is once the investigation is complete, the international community need to identify some of the culprits and charge them with crimes against humanity or war
crimes.
Can
that be done now?
It's so tainted because
the rebels control this area since Thursday,
right? But I think if you were only to indict a couple of the rebels, it could be a game changer. Because having an indictment against a leader, whether it's a rebel group or a legitimate head of state, can change the situation drastically for the international community and for the rebels or a head of state.
410-662-8780 is our phone number for Midday if you'll want to comment on that story as well. In the meantime, we'll go back to the situation in Gaza and hear from Michael in Baltimore. Michael, thank you for calling.
Yes, I want to address the historian by bringing up the Wall Street article about the origin of Hamas. Again, it's misleading. You always have to look in the context. When Israel helped the establishment of Hamas, that was the late 70s. And just like when we supported the people that came out as Al-Qaeda and Taliban, it was mm-hmm. against the Soviet Union. Everything has to be in context. I don't think you can make just as good an argument that it was in Israel's interest to support Hamas. And they were an offshoot of the the Brotherhood in Egypt.
Yeah, let me just say, I don't think I'm with you. And Mihailu also called. You know, I think Professor Katz was trying to give us a little historic perspective here, and not blame Israel for Hamas's operations. Now, I mean, this is crazy to talk about it today. You were just trying to give us the perspective, I believe.
Right. I was just trying to give a little bit of context.
Yeah.
I will say, if you take a look at the article, there are individuals, members of who participated in the support that was given to Sheikh Yassin at the time, who did say, we should be careful about what we're doing here. So there is some perspective in that. I would encourage you to read about this before you simply say, don't blame Israel for this.
Okay?
So take a look at this before you're simply blaming the messenger. I'm giving you a little bit of background on this. I think in perspective as well, the U.S., there were critics as well saying, don't arm the rebels. There's a long history of the United States supporting groups that have come back to haunt the United States as well. We have a long history of supporting the wrong group that has come back to haunt us, and we don't learn from our own mistakes either. So be careful about simply saying, well, don't blame Israel for doing what it's doing. Pay attention to the historical context and its continuation into the future.
Okay, and Michal wanted to make one other point he's been holding to.
She,
I'm sorry, Michal.
Hi.
Hello? Yeah, go right ahead, please.
So I wanted to make two comments, one of which was kind of brought up, but I still think it's worth addressing again, which is earlier one of your guests mentioned that, you know, had Israel stuck to attacking military places, it would not receive the censure it is getting for civilian casualties. And as another caller already mentioned, you know, Hamas has a history of purposefully planting. It's not just, you can't say it's just because of a dense population, because there are photos, they recently found rockets in two different schools and, you know, at hospitals and in cases where Israel warns civilians to get out of the way through phone calls, through leaflets, through, you know, giving a small warning, we're coming now. Hamas has actually called on citizens to be human shields and has encouraged them and told them to stay so that Israel either has to not take down the missiles and therefore subject their own civilians to danger, or end up with civilian casualties and the world censure. You know, whereas in Israel they build bomb shelters and many of their citizens are safe because they have bomb shelters, because they have invested in Iron Dome and security measures. And conversely, Hamas has built all these tunnels, but they don't have bomb shelters. They don't encourage their citizens to use bomb shelters, and instead they call on them to be human shields and use them to, and therefore are partially and largely responsible for the great casualties and the imbalance in numbers.
Okay, Michal, thank you very much.
Let me respond to this, and let me be very clear about this. The issue of the human shields is a very large part of Israel's propaganda machine. Amnesty International examined this very carefully and very clearly after the 2012 caste-led operation that Israel embarked on. And what it found is that there was no evidence that Hamas used human shields in Gaza. No evidence of it at all. What it has shown is that Israel has used human shields in different places in the West Bank. It used Palestinians as human shields if it felt that there was going to be booby-trapped homes or whatnot in different parts of the West Bank. So Israel has used human shields. There has not been evidence of this, that Hamas has used human shields. But it sounds very good in the United States and to the Israeli public to say that Hamas calls on Palestinians to stay, to stand on rooftops and other things, but there has not been any evidence of this. And so I think that we need to be careful about throwing this, bandying this term about.
Is this an intractable problem? It's a question that I guess you could have asked it 20 or 30 years ago. Actually, maybe we had more hope 20 or 30 years ago for a resolution of this conflict now. So I want to turn to Max on that. Where do you go with this present situation to try to resolve this? First, if you can get past the ceasefire, how do you change the situation?
Some would say you just let both sides fight until they're tired of fighting and we'll get to the negotiating table. Some would argue we've missed an opportunity, that the United States is no longer deemed an honest broker, although the United States is probably the only major power that has influence on both sides that could achieve something. Mm-hmm. But I think the broader problem in the Middle East is such that it's becoming increasingly more difficult to have a peace settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians, given the other priorities the United States has in the region, whether it's with Iran and its nuclear weapons, or it's ISIS, or it's the situation in Syria. So we now have so many burning issues on the table that it's becoming overwhelming for any one president to deal with. And of course, President Obama has 1,000 days or less left in office. He certainly doesn't want his legacy to go up in flames in trying to bring about a peace settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians that have outlived maybe 5 or 6 presidents. So I think the president realized it's not the best to invest his political capital on at this point and focus on something else that is more achievable. And probably that's why we see the disengagement of this president from trying to forge a peace settlement in the Middle East, because it's not worth his political capital.
And with elections coming up in November, I don't think he's going to do much more than try to ensure that the guns go quiet.
Kimberly Katz from Towson University, where she's an associate professor of history and an expert in the Middle East, has been our guest in this hour of the show. Max Hilaire is chairman of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
I wanted to read a couple of emails before we close out regarding the situation of the children at the U.S.-Mexico border or coming across the border, and the question about what we do in this country in terms of housing them while their situations are adjudicated through the Immigration Service. A couple of emails in here. Cynthia says, I am a teacher in Baltimore and Anne Arundel County and have taught some students from Central America who were in our country due to gang violence. One 11-year-old student of mine had been kidnapped when she was 9 or 10 and held until the family could pay money for her release. Another 10-year-old student's family was told that she and her sister might be kidnapped if the family didn't pay a fee. What would you do if your children were threatened like this? What if you suspect the police and government in your country of being part of the problem? These children and their families are caught in the crossfire between gang violence, corruption, and poverty, and our callous immigration policy. Darlene, with a different view, says all illegals using our money and resources must be sent back to where they came from. We are all descendants of immigrants who respected the route of coming and becoming U.S. citizens. People who are cheating the system need to be sent back, and no one should be allowed to be here illegally. All the children using public school resources must be sent back. If the United States stood firm and sent all illegals back, protected the borders, others trying to come in would stop trying to come in. Barbara writes that she agrees with Governor O'Malley that we should not deport these children, but find them houses to live here while their situations are adjudicated. And Reverend Courtney Stang Tregear says, according to my research, San Pedro Sula, the capital of Honduras, has a murder rate 5 times that of Baltimore City. How can we not have compassion for these children and families for what they are enduring? If you care to comment on that or anything else you heard during this hour of midday, please write to me at midday@wypr.org. That closes out our first hour of the show. Another hour of midday ahead with the guest host, Nikki Gamer. We'll take a break here for lunch provided on Tuesdays by the Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pasta, salads that are made fresh daily. It's open daily from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and delivery is available nightly from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. Please stay tuned for the news and then the second hour of our show.